welcome to Sukkot, because why not? Sukkot is here. Yes. Sukkot is here. We are in Perek Chet, chapter 8, Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, we're on page 1855. We started on this discussion last time. We read through the psukim, we read through the verses, and we noted the problems already. So I'm not going to go back over that again. But it's for those who forgot from last time or who weren't here. It's sentences 13 to 17 is what we're talking about, and here we are told that the Jews observe Sukkot. They observe this holiday, but it seems to come as something of a surprise, right? We said in sentence 14 in Pasuk Yudalet that on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, they're reading from the Torah, and they find, lo and behold, that there's an imperative from Moshe that you're supposed to sit in the Sukkot on the holiday in the seventh month. And not only that, but in Pasuk Yudzayim, in sentence 17, we were told that they had not had a Sukkot. It sounds like they had not made Sukkot, I should say, since the days of Yahushua. So the question is Sukkot really a surprise for them? Was there really no Sukkot in the time of King David? In the time of King Solomon? Right? I mean, ad kidei kach, to go that far with it, is that really what's going on here? So there are a few different approaches to this problem. No one is willing to take seriously the idea that Sukkot simply appears, poof, in the beginning of the Second Temple period, and that this text here in Tanakh is telling us that, oops, we just ignored this all along, and now we found it to be written in the Chumash. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit the historical record. And so no one really goes that route. However, among the different approaches to this, there are two different schools. One school of thought looks at sentence 14, which says they found recorded in the Torah that God commanded that they should sit in the Sukkot, and does not see it as an expression of surprise, not they were shocked to find there is this thing, but simply they were reading from the Torah, and they saw the description, and they weren't surprised by it. The only thing we have to deal with is the assertion in sentence 17, which says they hadn't had one since Yahushua. That's the part that they focus on, and many commentaries go that route. We will see a little bit later on that there were others who said no, they actually were surprised, and we'll come back to that point of view. But within this view that they weren't surprised, but now they're going to observe Sukkot, there are three different takes. The simplest approach is the one brought by Ralbag, and that's what you have here in source number one. Lo asu, right? Quoting from sentence 17, they hadn't made Sukkot since the days of Yahushua. Ratzelomar, meaning, liyos leiv kol habayim sham tov im Hashem. V'lekro yom biyom b'sefer Torah Elokim. He says, when it says they didn't make Sukkot in the days of Yahushua, it doesn't mean that they didn't have Sukkot. It means that they didn't have Sukkot in this way. To have everybody there have a positive approach to God, to read from the Torah each day, he says, I think that was what they did in the time of Yahushua, and then not again until this time. Alternatively, it's that no one since the days of Yahushua, you hadn't seen a Sukkot in which everybody has this level of fervor and excitement and celebration, not since the days of Yahushua. So according to Ralbag, it's not saying that you didn't have Sukkot observed. It's saying that you didn't have this kind of energy to it or this kind of commitment to Torah. That's one take. He has the idea of the historical parallel on his side. Meaning, the point is, we came into the land for the first time under Yahushua, and we were all excited, right? We get to build a sukkah and we get to do all of this. And then we come back in the Second Temple period, and again we have such excitement which we hadn't had since that original experience. It's a reasonable take. The problem is what? What's the problem with the approach? No, Sukkot. You build a sukkah with or without a temple, right? It isn't about having a temple.
There have been other opportunities, the building of it. There were other opportunities for excitement, and it's still very disturbing that these words were used. And it's something that obviously all of them are grappling with because they can't come to terms with the concept. That it hadn't been observed.
Well, it's not just that they can't come to terms with it. It doesn't make historical sense. Meaning, it's not as though the secular, historical, and critical readers take the sentence literally either. They all look at it and say, you can't have maintained the temple for centuries with sacrifices and everything else and just dropped.
Wow.
It doesn't make any sense. But just, hang on. I have Janine next. Bree there. I have Ralph there. I'm seeing. The beginning of the first temple would not have had this level of excitement to it because it's a personal mitzvah. It's when I observe Sukkot. It's not about having a temple. What they're saying here is that everybody was so excited about observing this holiday. I remember what it was like the first time that I built my own sukkah, right? We were on our own. We had an apartment. We put together a sukkah. And it was a little nothing, 6 feet by 6 feet, if that much. Barely fit the table. But it was my sukkah. There's a sense of excitement that comes with that, and you can see that may inform what Ralbag is saying. I have a different problem with it, which is that it isn't what the text says. Is that what Janine was going to say? It's not what it says. It says ki lo asu mimei Yoshua ben Nun kein bnei Yisrael ad hayom ahu, that from the days of Yoshua they had not made like this. And it really sounds like the antecedent for like this is the sukkah, not the Torah reading. But that's Ralbag, and Ralbag is very attentive to text. Ralbag likes pshat. He likes a simple read. But that's what he comes up with. Jeannie?
Well, they talk about everybody before that. They made individual sukkot and at these courtyards, etc. Maybe there were more joint sukkot or something. It sounds like there was... It goes to enthusiasm, it's the same idea. But maybe that's a source for it. That it talks about... It tells you all the places where they made the sukkot.
Interesting.
You're called Sharet, right?
Interesting. So I'll tell you to hold that thought until we get to the Malbim, because that may be supported by what Malbim is going to say.
Yeah.
We'll have to... We'll have to see. We'll come back. Hang on.
Maybe they didn't, where they were looking for, they couldn't get it.
They were in this country. They were in this country. Of course they had it.
So it was all proximate to them, and isn't it that they couldn't get
it? I think so. I would be surprised to hear that they didn't have the means of it before. And Bruria, what were you going to say? I'm going in order.
You covered me.
Okay. Ralph and then Dahlia.
Well, it seems to me that there's something missing out of the way they have done it. And they've taken up the tradition that they've missed out on.
Right. So the excitement is that but again, why weren't they doing it, let's say, when they were in Babylon? Or weren't they doing it when they were back in the land already?
Well, they were in Babylon.
But this event, we have two different versions of when this event takes place. One version is that this is in that first generation. And in that case, you have an argument, maybe in Babylon they're not building Sukkot. Maybe. But according to the chronological read of the text, this is decades after they've come back. It's very hard to sustain.
There must have been something left out that they were now.
Besides, it says Minei Yehoshua. They were doing it during. I'm sure that they were not. That there were no sukkah to Yehoshua and Shoftim. We're talking. It doesn't say they were. It doesn't.
It says they weren't.
The first time they made it since the days of Yehoshua.
Yeah.
So it says I'm answering Ralph, but it's not saying we didn't do it for decades. We didn't do it for.
Right. The problem is it's not just Babylon. It sounds like First Temple also. Correct, Dahlia.
I don't think they ever built individual sukkahs to focus on. That's my guess. One of the reasons is that the way it says, my husband, I showed this to him last week because he's interested in what we are.
That's great. You don't have to give him an excuse.
Okay, so he said to me, in Iran, no one built individual sukkahs. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a thing. Ever. We're talking here thousands of years. Like, no one built them.
he traces his roots. He said there were shuls of it. Mm-hmm. He made a bracha and shul and he went home. That was it. There was only communal sukkahs. He said it wasn't a thing to make individual sukkahs. I still remember when we first got married, it was like, well, why do we have to, we're so broke this year, why do we have to build a sukkah?
And the answer is, it's easier than paying rent.
And up until then, you know, that was when we first had a house.
Right.
Because the sukkah was, as far as, you know, he looked at this and he said, I think that the same way they invented prayer and regular Torah readings, they invented this idea of the individual sukkah. And that's what we're learning.
So the problem with it, while I hear what you're suggesting, and I would even suggest that it would make more sense in their day to have a communal one because they're living in fear of attack. So from that perspective, I would say it would be more likely for this period. The problem is that the biblical imperative is so clear when it says, Kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael, right? Every individual citizen. It doesn't talk about it communally. I understand that communities may have shifted to a communal model, whether because of convenience, whether because people were not observing personally, but at least they would communally. You know, I'll make kiddush and shul and have some food there, as opposed to, you know, doing a Shabbos meal at home. But it's really hard to think that at this stage, when you have this level of ritual as part of the everyday life of Jews, I don't mean this stage now, I mean all through the First Temple period, you know, to think that this just drops off the map. I find it very hard to sustain. The idea of the communal and personal is one we're going to come back to when we talk Malbim. So you know, hold off on that a little bit. But this is hard. The Talmud has a remarkable read, which it offers two alternative reads, which can only be classified as drash. The drash. Remember what drash is. Drash doesn't care about historical records. Drash cares about harmonizing the text. I have a text, and I need to understand why this word was used over that word, why the spelling was used over that one, and I need to tell a story which fits the text that I have in front of me. So they draw on. The Gemara draws on one answer that is halachic and the other one that is agadic, and neither of them has to do with Ezra and Nehemiah at all, except that they come to intersect with our story. So the first one is about a halachic issue. Here's the question. How does the land of Israel gain the holiness of being the land as far as Jewish ritual is concerned? We have laws about where the mitzvah of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, will apply, which land has to be allowed to rest, the division of the land, the rules for which offerings can be consumed and where in the land they can be consumed. How does that happen? How does the land become sacred? How did that happen? It wasn't always true. It isn't as though you say the land always had it and always will. It's not so. The initial sanctity is conferred by the Jews who enter under Joshua when they do the division of the land among the Shevatim, among the tribes. But then there's a debate. Is that original sanctity eternal? So the land receives it under Joshua and that's the way it's always going to be. Or does it halt when we are kicked out of the land? And then it has to be restored when the Jews come in under Zerubbabel. That's the debate. And there are both views that appear talmudically that has interesting practical ramifications that are beyond the scope of the conversation right now. But take a look at source number two. This is a piece of the Talmud's discussion about the sanctity of the land, and specifically the view that says that the initial sanctification under Joshua actually halted when the Babylonians evicted us from the land. Basically, the way the argument goes is that the original sanctity was conferred by conquest, and therefore it is eliminated by conquest. We conquered...
Assyrians?
Sorry?
And the Assyrian movement of the people?
Right, so they already knocked out... They knocked out the first, you know, the first 10 tribes... Right? And then the other two are knocked out by the Babylonians. And in waves, the sanctity is lost. Does the north lose its sanctity when the northern tribes are gone? Or does it wait until they're all gone? I don't know. That's an interesting question.
What sanctity is conferred?
by the fact that they're there.
No, by conquest. You took hold of the land, it became yours.
But it's not just yours. We're talking about sanctity. Does that make it more than just ownership?
The right, but the sanctity is associated with ownership. In other words, when the land becomes associated with the tribes of Israel, that's also what gives it its religious status.
Okay, that's
yeah.
Religious status, not just ownership.
Correct. No, but it's religious status that it comes as a function of ownership.
And that comes as a function of conquest.
Correct. When Yeshua comes in, and when they are conquered.
So that then the land loses that.
He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. That's the idea. Okay. Correct. Whereas the second entry into the land is with the permission of the Persians. It's not conferred by conquest, and therefore, when the Romans conquer us, the sanctity is not lost. The sanctity remains. That's the idea. There's a lot more to be said about this. It's a great debate with many ramifications, but not where we're going right now. So if you take a look at number two, you find within the context of this debate, they want support for the view that says that the original sanctity, the one under Joshua, did not last forever, and in fact halted. My time a demanda amar kedusha rishona kitchel ashaita velo kitchel asad lava. What's the rationale? What's the reason? What's the support for the idea that the first kedusha, the first holiness, was only temporary? Dichsiv, and they quote Nehemiah chapter 8, sentence 17, which is the one that says that they sat in Sukkot, they hadn't done this since the days of Joshua. So the Talmud says, well, that can't mean they didn't sit in Sukkot. That doesn't make any sense. Efsher, but David velo asu Sukkot adjeba Ezra. What, David came along and didn't make a Sukkot? Ezra had to do it. Ela makish biasam bimei Ezra la biasam bimei Yoshua. Rather, we are linking the arrival under Ezra, loosely under Ezra, it's really Zerubbabel, with the arrival under Yoshua. Ma biasam bimei Yoshua manushmitin viyovlos vikitchu are choma. Af biasam bimei Ezra manushmitin viyovlos vikitchu are choma. He says the message here is that when they came in under Joshua, they started the count of Shemitah, the sabbatical year. They started the count of the Jubilee year. They dedicated the walled cities. And that happened under Yoshua, and it also happens under Ezra. In other words, what this read in the Talmud is doing is a drasha on the association of Ezra with Yoshua. To say that, the text must have made this link for a different reason. It's not that there were no Sukkot since the days of Yoshua. Rather, it's that it's trying to tell me there's a common denominator between the arrival under Yoshua and the arrival under Ezra. And what is that common denominator? Initiating the sanctity of the lands. The Talmud then asks, wait a minute, take a step back. The Idach. What's the other side going to say then? According to the view that the sanctification of the land was eternal and therefore there was no need to re-sanctify it, to rededicate it in the days of Ezra, what are you going to do with this verse? And here we get the second explanation. And this is really remarkable. The Idach. Deboi rachmi al yetzer da'avodazara ubitlei. It's teaching me something completely different. Ezra prayed to eliminate the yetzer, the desire in a person to worship idols. That's what Ezra did, and he got rid of the desire to worship Avodah Zarah. V'agin zechusa alayu ki sukkah. And Ezra's merit protected them like a sukkah. Where in the world did this come from? We'll get there in a minute. V'hainu, but they continue to say, V'hainu dekakapit kray ilaved Yoshua. Go back to sentence 17. Notice that Yoshua's name is written Yeshua. He lost the hay, which we associate always with God's name, right? We talk about Hosea, Yehoshua, God should save you, and all of that. The text is actually angry at Yehoshua. Divchol duchta ksiv Yehoshua, v'acha ksiv Yeshua. We lost, he lost a letter. Because Moshe doesn't pray to eliminate the desire for idolatry, because the Jews aren't meritorious enough. They're not living in Israel. But Yoshua, he has the merit of living in Israel. So why in the world didn't he daven for it? And that's what the text is doing. It's contrasting Ezra and Yoshua to say, look at what the wonderful thing that Ezra did. He protected them with his merit. Yoshua did not. So the... So that is the big question. Where is this coming from? And the answer is, as so often in Drash, you need to know more than the text that's in front of you. Drash, in generally speaking, is relying on a full knowledge of Tanakh, not just the verse that's in front of you, and we have to go elsewhere in Tanakh in order to know what they're doing. Ralph, and then we're going to go and see where this is from.
First of all, you have a...
I had 28 years, come on. 28 years. Yeah.
And ritual. And secondly, it's historical fact that the Jews, even in the land, in that time, they were not as observant as they should be. They'd be traditional for a while, and then they sink back into...
But they'd be traditional for a while. You have periods of tradition. It's true that you have ongoing battles with idolatry. That's absolutely true. But to pretend that this mitzvah just disappeared for centuries is bizarre.
Well, it doesn't say it disappeared.
Sure it does. Read sentence 17.
It wasn't the same.
No. I mean, you're taking Ralbag's read. But that's an interpretation. That's Ralbag's read. But I don't think that's the I don't think that's the simple read of the sentence at all.
Kol HaKahal is the clue here.
What do you mean?
Well, it's not that the whole congregation didn't do this. Kol HaKahal.
So you're anticipating what we're going to see.
Just a small portion of the Jews were keeping it. The Levim, the Kohanim. Wherever they were, around the country, the wet
mind,
right. Yeah, whatever.
Right, so Dalia is...
It was not common practice.
Right, Dalia is with the Sfaradim in our group, meaning the Kuzari and the Rashba are going to take that view, so you're in good Spanish company. But let's just hold off, because I'm trying to do it in order here. Take a look on page 1413. 1413, Zechariah. It's Zechariah chapter 5. 14, it's not in there. You need a Tanakh. Zechariah chapter 5. If someone could pass Ralph the Tanakh, please, that would be helpful. Thanks.
I don't have that. What
Zechariah chapter 5.
What does it come after? Jonah?
It's the very end of the 12.
Okay.
Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. The very end of the prophets before you get to the writings.
Chapter 5.
Sentence 8. Page 1413 for those who have the stone Tanakh. This is one of Zechariah's visions. Zechariah, remember, for those who were here when we did it, is filled with visions. And here, he has a vision which starts in the beginning of the chapter here with a flying scroll. And he's taught about the meaning of the scroll, and essentially there's a decree of punishment that is coming. And then take a look at sentence 5. We'll start from sentence 5. I think it's probably the best place to start. The Vayetzei Amalach Hadover Bi Vayomer Elai Sana Inecho Re'e Maha Yotzeis Hazos. A Malach says to him, pick up your eyes and see what is emerging. Vayomer Mahi, and I said, what is that? Vayomer, and he said, Zos Ha'efa Hayotzeis. And he says, this is an Efa. An Efa is a volume measure. That's what it is. It's a dry volume measure, generally speaking. So this is a receptacle of some kind, the size of an ephah. Vayomer zos einam b'chol ha'aretz. And he said to me, this is for the eyes that are throughout the land, as the art scroll notes here, it's an image of greed. This is for those whose eyes are everywhere. V'hine kikar oferes niseis. And then there was a piece of lead that was lifted up. Vizos Isha Achas Yosheves Biso Haifa, and lo and behold, there is a woman sitting inside the Eifa. Vayomer, and he said, Zos harish'ah, this is the wicked one. Vayashlecho sal tocha eifah, cast her into the eifah. Vayashleches evan ha'oferes alpia, and he covered the lid, he covered the opening in the eifah with this piece of lead. And then two more women come along and they carry off the eifah to Babel, to Babylon. No, it's not, because there are two women who are righteous who are taking it away. It's one woman who's wicked and two women who are righteous. That's pretty good. That's better than the men. Yes. So the question is, as always in Zechariah, what in the world are you talking about? What is this image? So we're not revisiting all the commentaries to this from when we did Zechariah. For those who are interested, you can catch it on YU Torah. But what the Talmud is about to do is to come up with an explanation for what is going on with this image of the Eifah, the woman who's being put away inside the Eifah and cast to Babel. What is this all about? Remember that Zechariah is the beginning of the Second Temple. He's contemporary with Ezra and with the stories that we've been reading. So what exactly is it that Zechariah is telling the Jews of Ezra's day when he describes a woman being put into an eifah and being flown off to Babylon? So take a look at source number 3, which is the Talmud in Yuma, where we get the Talmud's explanation of what's going on there, which will explain what we saw in source number 2. Then you wonder why the sheets are so long. It's because you have all this material. Vayitzaku el Hashem Elokim b'kol gadol. So it borrows from the beginning of Nehemiah chapter 9. We haven't seen it yet, but we are going to find that right after Sukkot, there's a big fast that's declared, and they cry out to God in a kol gadol, in a great voice. So my Omer, what exactly did they say to God when they cried out? Amar Rav said, V'yitem Rabbi Yochanan said, Bai is like vei. Like oi vei? Whoa. Hainu hai de achreve lemakdisha, v'kalye lehechle v'katlinu lekulu tzadike, v'aglinu liyisrael me'arahon. You know why we've been so bad? There is an influence that has made us so bad. This is why we're fasting on the 24th day of Tishrei. This is what caused us to be so lowly. There is something that caused the destruction of the temple. V'adayin merakeid beinon. And it still dances among us. Klum yahavte lan el kabule be'agra, lo iu ba'inan v'lo agri ba'inan. You only gave us this in order that we should be rewarded for fighting it. And we don't want it, and we don't want the reward. In other words, they complain to God, saying, we've sinned, we've done terrible things, and you'll see that reiterated in the next chapter. And they turn to God and say, enough. We don't need the temptation anymore. God, take away temptation. And when you talk about temptation for the Jews of this period, the top temptation is idolatry. Is Avodah Zarah. That's what they're most familiar with. The number 2 temptation is the women of the nations around them. Those are their 2 main concerns. So they say, we don't want idolatry, we don't want to be tempted to idolatry, and that's how they explain Zechariah's vision. Keep on reading. Osivu b'ta'anisa tzlasa yom and tzlasa l'alvasa. They fasted for 3 days and 3 nights. Masruhu ni'alayu. And they were given control of the desire for idolatry. Nafak asa ki gurya dinura mi base kashya kadashim. An image like a fiery lion comes out of the Holy of Holies. And Amarlu Navili Yisrael Hainu Yisra Davodazara. And the prophet says to the Jews, this is it, that's the Yetzer for idolatry. And he quotes our passage right here, the Zos HaRishah, this is wickedness, this is the wicked one. It shouldn't say wickedness in the translation. No, it's not, it's Rishah. Zos HaRishah is still feminine. So he is the one who's speaking. He is the one who's speaking. Vayomer is the one who's speaking. It's the Malach. Yeah, no, we didn't stop. It's still an evil woman. It is. Sorry. This is the wicked one. So they grab it and they put it away, and that's the whole business of putting it into the jug and covering the mouth with lead, the lead to absorb the sounds, this way you can't hear the call for idolatry. And then, once they do that, then there's this next push, which I'm not going to go through inside in the text in the interest of time, but you can see it there, where they say, hey, you know, we managed to eliminate idolatry. Let's make it two for two. Let's get rid of the desire for the women of the nations around us as well. But they run into trouble because you've all heard this before. What happens when you eliminate that? There are no fresh eggs. Meaning it's a function of the desire to procreate. You can't say that I'll get rid of part of it and not the rest of it. It doesn't work that way. So what you're seeing here, this is the core drash. This is the core drasha is in source number 3. Is really about Zechariah. It's not about Ezra and Nehemiah. That's a sideshow. The main point is, number one, to explain what it was that Zechariah saw. And number two, to answer a logical problem which everybody asks. By the time you hit the times of the Talmud, everybody wants to know the answer to this question, which is, why in the world did they all worship idols? We don't feel any pull towards worshiping idols. I mean, you can come up with all sorts of nice thoughts about what constitutes idolatry today, and people are greedy, and people are this. But the bottom line is that you don't feel the pull today to worship idols, and it's not just today. 2,000 years ago, you didn't feel the pull to worship idols. If you remember the story with, I think it was Rav Huna and Menashe, right? Rav Huna, who criticizes Menashe. He makes light of Menashe. Menashe being the king who led the Jews for 22 years into idolatry. And then Menashe comes to him in a dream and says, if you had been around in my day, you would have picked up your skirt and gone running to worship the idols. You don't know what you're talking about, you know, when you deal with this, because you didn't have the desire we had. And what the Talmud is doing here is it's trying to answer the question of why, when you open up Tanakh, you can't go two pages without somebody worshiping idols. And in our day, it's not a temptation at all. And the answer is, because God eliminated it. And that's what Zechariah is saying here. Rebecca.
Except yeah. That I open up the Gemara and I say, why are they so fixated on Shadim, on these spirits and things like that?
But they're not fixated on it.
Well,
what do you mean by fixated?
Like how you get them, how you rid of them, how they, you know, they appear in Gemara and eyes in the 20th and 21st.
Right, but that's a different question. In other words,
but I'm just saying that in different times. I understand, but
they're not worshiping them.
Oh no, they're not worshiping them. But we're talking about things that one doesn't understand. I mean, I understand that during the time of the Torah, idolatry was around, and that's what people turned to when they didn't understand things. You know, when
the question is not. I understand what you're asking. I think the question that the Talmud is dealing with here is a different question. They're not dealing with the question of why did they believe in idolatry. They're dealing with the question of why they wanted to worship it. Why was this something that they were at all fascinated by? And you're in a pre-scientific age, meaning in the first century Common Era, people are no longer running after Baal Peor. Even though it's not as though they have scientific explanations for why there's thunder and lightning.
I guess maybe I'm incorrect, but I think the reason that I went there is that people look for answers to what's going on around them, and it was easier to turn to idolatry than to some being that they couldn't see or whatever in terms of God. And then during the time of Gemara, people are looking for answers and they think of Shaitan. Right. I mean, it's just.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know what to make of Shadim anyway. Yeah, Janine.
Do we read a lot about Avodah Zarah in the time of Yehoshua?
So in Yehoshua itself, no. The Gemara makes the point. The Gemara makes the point that the Jews followed Hashem all the days of Yehoshua, as the text says. However, once you're in the Shoftim period, it's filled with Avodah Zarah.
So I know that. So why would Yehoshua be blamed for not, like, he could have prayed for anything. Like, why would he? Because it wasn't an issue at that time.
In other words, he's saying that's why Yeshua didn't go for it, because this wasn't an issue in his day. I don't know. It's an interesting point. Maybe that's why Yeshua didn't do anything, because he thought he had beaten it.
He needed spiritual leadership.
You don't call the exterminator until you have mice. Right. It's an interesting point. I don't know. Yes, Moshe.
Yeah,
Moshe says he doesn't know what he's talking about. Yes, go ahead.
Going back to Delia's point, which I actually find myself taking to very much, and I wonder whether Sukkot individually were confused with Asherah stuff, and all this stuff kind of is agricultural.
Okay. And therefore
maybe,
what?
So maybe they could only do it in large congregations with the shul. There wouldn't be a fear that this individual.
So I'm gonna spare Moshe's voice. Yes.
And if you're doing like your individual thing with your lulav and everything, maybe you try to set this little shrine that you're setting up in your backyard, which is like.
See, it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea for those who couldn't hear. The Moshe is suggesting that maybe it was actually intentional. That they wouldn't observe Sukkot privately, but only do so communally, lest it creep into idol worship following the goddess of the harvest, as Dalia mentioned.
They used to worship trees. That was very.
I want to suggest two more things. Maybe the way idolatry came into being, and this relates to syncretism. Particularly, is that it was in the house in a small way. They would go to Syria. They would buy some pieces of pottery, but they were also idols. They would have idols in their house. I mean, one of the things that I find remarkable is this very city that Saul hears. One of the arguments is that there actually was no actual Avodah Zarah, but the women would have a necklace. The Avodah Zarah on their the bracelet necklace, just the necklace. And if a man was being intimate with her, he had no choice but to, alleged have the imagination, bow to the idol. But that's all it was. That's all it was. That's all it was. That's
all my mother.
Don't know. Don't know. In terms of the general idea, I think it's an interesting idea that they would have, limited Sukkot to a communal setting for religious safety reasons, so to speak. The problem is that the view of this seems to be negative. In other words, we're righting a wrong by now having it. It doesn't sound like it was a negative, but I hear what you're saying. I think it's a fascinating idea, and it points to an interesting question of what exactly, of what do we do with religious ritual when we are afraid that it might creep into something other than what we want. And the classic example of this, the Talmud has a passage where it talks about fast days. And certain fast days that were taken on at different times, and one of them involved fasting on Sundays. It's a longer story. It involves ma'amadot, shifts of non-Kohanim, non-Levim, who would travel to the temple and they would have a shift for a week of prayer and support services and so on. And they would fast on certain days, and they stopped fasting on Sundays when the Christians started to observe Sunday as a holy day because they didn't want to feed into that idea. Like, oh, look, the Jews also treat it as a holy day. So, there is something to be said for halting or altering our practices lest they support what we view as idolatrous. That said, I would want to see evidence to support the idea that they did this to Sukkot in order to avoid that problem. I think that requires some more support for it. But again, what this is doing here is the sages of the Talmud are bothered, as are the historians, as are the critics, as is everybody, with this allegation that they haven't observed Sukkot since the days of Yahushua. And whereas Ralbag's answer is, of course they observed Sukkot, just not with this enthusiasm, the Talmud's answer is, it's actually talking about something entirely different, and the association between Ezra and Yahushua is entirely different. Either it's not talking about Sukkot at all, it's talking about the sanctification of the land, or it's that Zechariah in that period speaks of elimination of something evil, which for them would have been the desire for idolatry, And that's what Ezra is celebrating here. Ezra is their sukkah. He is their shelter, where Yahushua was not. Is this a very strange read? You bet. That's not in question. It's certainly not a literal read of the text. It's far from it. But what it really is a drash trying to explain Zechariah and trying to answer the logical question of what happened to idolatry, and it exists on its own. Even if the book of Nehemiah had never been written, this drash would be there. But now it actually can be imported in order to address a problem. It's certainly not the first approach I would take to the issue. One more approach, also suggesting that it's not a surprise to them at all, is Malbim. And this is fascinating, especially in light of the comments being made about Sukkot in public. First of all, Malbim says, remember that we talked about how in Ezra chapter 3 they had a celebration of Sukkot already. And so we asked at the time, I don't understand, if they have a celebration already of Sukkot in Ezra chapter 3, why is it a surprise now? So one answer is, these are both the same event. But the other answer is found in source number 4, where he says that when it said in Ezra Vayasu et Chaga Sukkot that they made the celebration of Sukkot, Hainu b'Halel v'Simcha v'Olazriya v'Shamicha Giga v'Arba Minim. It meant that they sang to God. It meant that they brought their offerings. It meant they did the four species, Lulav, Esrog, and so on. Hagam Shlo Kimuaz Mitzvah Sukkah Karaoi, but they didn't do Sukkah at that stage. And Malbim believes that that's true. They're two separate events, but the Jews actually observed Sukkot in that initial version without a Sukkah. And now, in source number 5, he explains why. Sorry?
That's what I said.
That what?
They had reverted, they didn't know.
That's not where he's going.
Got it back together again.
That's not where he's going. Take a look at source number 5. He has an extremely novel read. He links it to a halacha which many people are unfamiliar with. And that is, as he quotes from the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in the Shulchan Aruch, but it's an idea that goes back to the Gemara itself, you're not allowed to build a sukkah on public land. Not allowed to build a sukkah on public land. Why not?
Doesn't belong.
No. Let it is. It's not yours. It's called theft. It's called theft. You can't build your sukkah in a public space.
In Israel, they build the sukkah.
Hang on. Hang on. We're getting there. Really. Take a look at source number 5. But yes, Sharon is correct in pointing out where this is going. It's going back to sentence 16, which had them building the sukkah in all the public spaces. So now, take a look at source number 5. V'nira l'fima shekasav ha-ramah ba'orachayim tafrish lamed zayin. He says, look at the Ramah. Rabbi Moshe Isserles is writing in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. She'ein laso sukkah b'rushas harabim. You're not allowed to put a sukkah in a public space. Im kein, if so. He says Jerusalem was not divided up among the tribes. There's a debate about this in the Talmud. One view is it's Yehuda and Binyamin. The other view is it's like Washington, D.C. It's not owned by anyone in particular. You don't own your land. There is no such thing as private property, as demonstrated by the following rule. There is no Airbnb in Jerusalem. You're not allowed to rent out space. When it comes time and everybody has to go for the festival, they can just crash in your house. You're not allowed to charge them for staying in your home because it's not yours. In Cain, lo yachlu laso sham sukkah, so they couldn't make a sukkah in Jerusalem. But when they came back under Ezra and they sanctified the land, at that point the court said, you know what? We are making a bunch of enactments, which the Talmud in Bava Kamma lists, which were geared towards handling municipal space. And one of the rules is going to be that you can make your sukkah anywhere in Jerusalem and in other public spaces in Israel. And he quotes you the Tosefta, a Talmudic source, which says, "Tonight, based in Chiyu, Mesakchen v'Rishus Harabim, that they made a rabbinic enactment that you could make schach, you can make a sukkah in public areas. Verotza lomer shezeh hisnu basin shel ezebosas manshim lokinu lo hayuchom lasa sukos birushalayim. He says that's the idea that they did this now, and that's why they were able to make their sukkot in, as described in sentence 16, they were choshar hamayim b'chatzrot beit elokim. They could do it in all of these, in all of these public spaces. And then he goes on to say that's why the Talmud had this whole discussion about re-sanctifying Israel at this stage. What in the world did that have to do with the sukkah? The answer is that's what enabled the sukkah. I'm not going through the rest of it because I'm looking at the time and realizing that we're getting to the end and we have so much to see still. So, three different approaches, none of which is willing to accept that anybody was surprised, but they're all wrestling with the question of, so why weren't they doing Sukkot until now? And all of these approaches are saying, of course they celebrated Sukkot, and of course they built Sukkot. You have Ralbag, who says they did it just without this fervor, without the Torah reading. You have the Talmud, which reads it in different ways, about the sanctification of the land, or about destroying the inclination for idolatry. And then you have Malbim, who says, no, they had private Sukkot until, though. They just didn't do public ones. Right? The reverse of Dalia's idea. Right? He has them, they made only private ones. They didn't make the public ones. But then we get to the last idea here. And the last idea is that they address both the surprise issue and the issue of not doing it since the days of Yahushua. And their answer is, both the Kuzari and the Rashba, that a lot of people, maybe even most people, were not building Sukkot all along. And the catch really is here, that here it is Kol HaKahal, it's the entire nation that's doing it. I brought you the Kuzari and the Rashba because they take slightly different views. Source number 6. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, writing in the Kuzari, in his dialogue, right? You're familiar with the Kuzari, you know, it's presented as a dialogue between a king of a nation who converts to Judaism and the Haber, this intellectual who speaks to him. So this is already, this passage here is after he's already converted, but he's still asking questions. And so he asks the question here, and I'm going to just work with the English in the interests of time. The Khazar king says, I did not see, only that the people of the Second Temple had already forgotten the Torah. Meaning, I can't but think that they had actually forgotten the Torah, not knowing the mitzvah of Sukkah until they found it recorded. This demonstrates the loss of the Torah. His statement is, look at the text. It says to you that they didn't know what a Sukkah was. They were surprised to find out. So the Chaver responds, this is not the word Chaver. Just for reference, it's an Arabic word. It's a different word. It means the intellectual. Like the, it may be associated with the word chaver as it's used Talmudically for somebody who keeps to certain strictures and certain laws more than others do. So the chaver says, well, I guess that means that we are wiser and more knowledgeable in Torah than they are. Because after all, we think we know the entire Torah. We think we're observing the whole thing. And the king says, yeah, that's what I mean. He went to great lengths to make this sound like a dialogue. That sentence added nothing. But he says, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So the Chaver says, well, I'm not sure I understand. Because if we had to bring Korbanot today, would we know how to do the slaughter? On what side? And he goes through, I skipped it, but all the details of a Korban. And what the Kohanim were obligated to do in terms of their holiness, in terms of purity, in terms of anointing everything. Like, we don't have the slightest clue how to observe those things. We know what a Sukkah is. We know what a Korban is. So the Chaver says, we wouldn't know. We would need a Kohen, we would need a prophet. So the Chaver responds, and here I just skipped in the interests of space. He says, but you see that the people of the Second Temple built an altar. So one who knows all these details of the Torah, could he not know how to make a sukkah? He says, are you telling me that they had a prophet teach them how to bring sacrifices, but they didn't know how to do sukkah? It doesn't make any sense to him. So Chazar says, well, they knew. You explain the pasuk. Then you explain what it means when it says, and they found recorded in the Torah. And the Chaver responds, clearly it is because the recorder of the text Was not sensitive. I know, because originally I didn't pay attention and I got rid of it. Was not sensitive to hidden matters, but only wrote that which was public and revealed. He did not record any of the wisdom Joshua received from God and Moshe, right? When you read Sefer Yehoshua, and when you read Sefer Devarim for that matter, we don't get any information about what the conversations were between Yehoshua and Moshe, just that Yehoshua never left his tent. But he recorded the day the Jordan halted, and the day the sun halted, and the day of the national circumcision, because they were publicized to the masses. But the intent of the text was to record only that which was known to the masses, which the entire nation carried. But the private matters held by individuals were lost from him, meaning the writer of the text, other than a minority of those matters. And so he did not record of the matters of Ezra and Nehemiah only that which was known to the masses. And the day of making the sukkah was a public day in the nation's agitation and ascending to the mountains for olive leaves and myrtle leaves and date leaves and leaves of grated wood. And when it said, and they found written, it means the nation and masses heard and they were agitated wanting to make sukkot. But individuals never lost an easy mitzvah, certainly a great one. And the text intended only to elevate that day. In other words, to make sure this is clear, what he's suggesting is the masses forgot about sukkah. There were always individuals who continued to observe, but yeah, the masses forgot about sukkah, going all the way back to the days of Yehoshua. That's the answer that that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi brings here. Leaders were observing sukkot all along, most were not. And then the Rashba in source number 7, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, also addresses it, and he says, and again I'm going to stick with the English, he says, the simple text shows they did not know the mitzvah of sukkah and of refraining from the Ammoni and Moavi. We're going to see that in chapter 9, the intermarriage issue. But it is not so, and meaning that everybody had forgotten. It is known that a nation cannot entirely follow the path of Torah, fulfilling all commands and avoiding all that the Torah prohibits, to the point that there will be no one who leaves the bounds of the Torah. Rather, some transgress knowingly out of compulsion from their desire, and some accidentally, not knowing or thinking. Certainly, when they were exiled and they scattered here and there in their exile, they encountered the trouble they encountered. And when they heard the Torah, they remembered what they remembered and repented, and one who had transgressed knowingly set his heart to regret it. This is why the Torah commanded to gather the entire nation, men, women, children, at the sabbatical year, in the midst of Hakel, is to have a public reading to reinforce these things. And so when Ezra read to them from the Torah scroll, they saw what was commanded. And one who had not yet heard this contemplated it. And one who had known and transgressed knowingly, all of them were very agitated at this when they heard the words of the Torah. And it is known from the days of Joshua, David, and Solomon, the children of Israel did make Sukkot. But not all of them did it as they did at this time, as I have said. So that's his conclusion. The answer is, the majority of the people were not observing Sukkot. That's his solution. So what we have are four approaches at the end of the day. You have Ralbag, who says you didn't have this kind of energy until now. You have the Talmud, which links it to other events, and it isn't saying anything about Sukkot. It's talking about the sanctification of the land or the elimination of the desire for idolatry. You have that they weren't making public Sukkot as described here until now. And you have the idea that the majority of the people really didn't make Sukkot. Clear? Which one you agree with, which one you like, I'm not even going to ask. I know the answer is probably 4 followed by 1, if I had to guess.
And number 2 is not really, the Talmud is not really an explanation. It's a flash, because it's interpreting Sukkah as nothing to do with the Sukkah. It's saying it's a Sukkah as a protection. It's like a totally different.
Yeah.
It's not an explanation.
Right. Number 2 is what, yeah. Okay. Maish.
Is there anything in Tanakh that actually cites Sukkot having been observed? I mean, I know it would come
either way. Right, no. Pesach, you have. You have several references. Yoshio, you get a reference with. Yoshua, you get a reference with. You get various references to Pesach celebrations. Chizkiyahu, you have a Pesach celebration. But Sukkot is naturally going to be different because Pesach is centered around a sacrifice that everybody has to bring. You have references to the first fruits being brought. Yeah. You have Bikurim references. Yeah. No one's staying up all night. No.
Yeah. The answer is, without a charismatic leader, we're just going to fall back into sinful ways.
Oh, that's kind of depressing. I'd hope not. Okay, so if you take a look back in Nehemiah, sentence 15, there was one piece here that really required some more conversation. Vasher Yashmiu, right? They make an announcement that they should go out to the mountains and they should bring Ale Zayit, right? We said last time, these are olive branches, oil wood. We talked about what oil wood might be, but other branches, hadas, dates, and then braided wood branches to make Sukkot. So what do we make of the list of species? Olive leaves, oil wood leaves, myrtle leaves, date palm leaves, and braided leaves. So the problem that you have here is that it sounds like you want to list the four species. Because you mention lulav, the palm branch, you mention the myrtle branch, the hadas, and you mention eitz avot, which is what the Torah uses when it's referring to hadas. But there's no etrog mentioned, and there are no aravot, there are no willow branches mentioned. So the question is, what is this about? So because we only have a couple of minutes, I'm just going to show you that I brought you the sources here in 8 and 9. But you have two different passages in the Talmud, two different views, in fact. The first view that's presented is in source number 8, and it tells us that the first three items on the list are meant for sukkah. The first three items on your list are sukkah materials. So ale zayit is the olive one, ale eitz shemen, oil wood, whatever the oil wood is, and the hadas, according to this, is referred to is what's called a hadas shote. The rule of the hadas is the myrtle branch. So myrtle branches that we seek to use for the mitzvah have levels of three leaves all the way up the stem. And the three leaves are supposed to emerge from the same tier on the stem all the way up, so they actually cover the stem. You get three leaves, three leaves, three leaves, three leaves. If the leaves are not synchronized, so that they emerge from different spots, and you don't have these neat layers of three leaves, that's called hadas shote, literally an irrational hadas, and it's disqualified from use. So what the Talmud is saying is, hadas here refers to the one that's not usable for the four species, and an eitz avot is a reference to the ones that are. And that's one approach. That this is actually blending the species you're bringing for the sukkah, that's your first three, and the ones you bring for the four species. However, the more fascinating one is the second one in source number 9, which says that there's actually a long-running debate with the Sadducees. The Talmud doesn't name the Sadducees, even Ezra does, about what materials you're supposed to use to make a sukkah. The Sadducees believed that when the Torah talks about taking for yourselves the four species to celebrate before God, they think it's not what we do. You take your lulav and esrog and all that. They believe that's what you're supposed to use for a sukkah. That the four species are actually your sukkah ingredients. I don't know how you make an esrog part of a sukkah. I don't know what that looks like. But that's the Sadducee idea, is that they're supposed to be the materials that make the sukkah. And that this verse is actually defeating that view and trying to say that these are all of these items are qualified for use to make the sukkah. Some of them are from the list of the four species and some of them are not.
The Sadducees don't take the four species separately.
Correct.
They combine it with
Correct. Fundamentally, what emerges in the Talmud here, and I'm sorry that I'm going through it so quickly, and maybe I should come back to the beginning next time, but what you see here is that there is an understanding that the two mitzvot are linked. What they're really about at the end of the day is prayers for rain, which is what you do at that time of year. It's the beginning of the rainy season, you hope. So you have your four species that you wave, and you go out into your hut outside. And what better time to pray for rain than when you're sitting in a hut outside? Well, here we wait for snow. We went out. But that's the idea, and the Sadducees take it and say it's all one mitzvah of Sukkah, and what we're trying to say is it's not. It's actually two different mitzvot. There's more to be said about this. Maybe I'll come back to this in the beginning next time. But everyone should drive safely, and hopefully see you on a warmer, drier Tuesday next week. Thank you.